all downhill after that. In what way? Dan asked. I came home early for Christmas one year in my mid-20s because my dad had been rushed to the hospital the night before with chest pain, and they discovered that he had 90% blockage in all five of his main arteries. He would need surgery the next morning. My mom woke me up early the next morning, and she said, Chelsea, your father just called and said he wants to wait until the spring for his bypass surgery, so I'm just going to go pick him up from the hospital. I could have hit my mother right then and there. That was so my mother, so passive and so easily pushed around. It drove me mad. Only my father would think he could wait and schedule bypass surgery during a more pleasant time of year, as if he were scheduling a garden party. That's the kind of asshole I was dealing with. I got out of bed and went into my mother's bathroom to brush my teeth. I used my parents' bathroom when I came home to visit, which was also odd because their bathroom was a complete shit show, a representation of my mother's European-style hygiene. My mission was to get him into the operating room, and there was no other possible outcome. When I was running out the front door into the snow in our driveway, I was in some version of pajamas or sleepwear, and for some reason I had thrown on my dad's UGG boots. My mom asked me if she should come, and I remember looking at her and thinking, definitely not. At the hospital, I screamed and yelled and threw one of the biggest tantrums of all time until he agreed to go into surgery. I fought so hard just to get a father, I couldn't stand to stick around. My brothers and sisters were shocked that I had gotten him into surgery because he could be so stubborn. They couldn't believe I had convinced him to do it. No one could convince my father of anything. I had proven myself to be responsible. I'd become someone you could rely on to get the job done. I liked that feeling so much. My family knew I meant business that day, that I was dependable, that the biggest fuck-up in the family could do something none of them had even tried to do, guide a rhinoceros into an operating room. The surprise in Simone's voice filled me with pride. Okay, they just took him in. Took him in where? To the OR. You're kidding me. How did you get him to do it? I threatened him mostly, I said, like a businesswoman. He'll be in the OR for 4 to 6 hours. I need you to bring me some shoes, preferably my own. I looked down at my footwear. Or some breath mints for Dad's Uggs. They smell like hard-boiled eggs. I had become a fixer, a true number 8. I didn't think about how scared my father must have felt or try to understand where he was coming from. I just needed to fix the situation for the family and for myself. I thought about the choice between life and death, and there wasn't a chance that was going to happen to us again. Not on my watch. I can't believe I convinced him to go through with a quintuple bypass just so he could go on to sexually harass the entire African-American and Cuban communities of the tri-state area. My brothers and sisters were kind enough to remind me of this every time he had another incident. My relationship with my father had always been about my version of things. I never contemplated what might have happened in his life to make him act the way he did. I never considered his story. I was a child, yes, but then I was an adult. It's hard for me to have sympathy for my father because a lot of his behavior I find inexcusable. But it's important for me to look at his story as independent from my own, and try to have a little empathy. I had never thought about being his child. I thought about him being my father, but never the other way around. Empathy. We both had none. I didn't know he lost his gas station after working 6 nights a week, that he was held up at gunpoint, that he came home early every Wednesday night with corned beef and pastrami sandwiches because he wanted time with his family, that he worked 14-hour days. This was all before I was born. It was all before Chet died. When Chet died, he was torn apart with grief, but he never gave up. He never threw in the towel. He could have gone off and left us, or he could have just killed himself. He didn't do either of those things. I don't know if it was the best he could do, but I also don't know that it wasn't. No person is just one thing. People can be filled with light and affection, and also be tortured and conniving and dishonest. Happiness can coincide with great pain. One can lead while also following, the same way one can follow while also leading. Dan asked me how all of this made me feel. I told him that I now understood my father's limitations along with my own. I thought our relationship was about me showing him how great I was, when truly he was most likely trying to prove to me how great he was. He was wondrously obsessed with himself, as I was with his affection for me. Today, I'm able to say with confidence that I do love my father. I don't know how much I like his behavior, but in the end, isn't love more valuable than like? I had a boyfriend when I was 18 years old. He was 28. He had a house in Belmar, New Jersey, and we would go there every weekend with my fake ID. He thought I was 20 because that's what I told him. Every Sunday when we would drive home from the shore back to our respective suburban dwellings, I knew I wouldn't see him for a few days because we both lived with our parents and sleepovers were a no-no for his parents. I doubt mine would have noticed. Every car ride, I fell silent, refusing to speak to him the whole way home because I hated that we would be separating. He would ask me every weekend what was wrong, but I didn't have the tools to express to him that I hated having to separate. That would have made me vulnerable, and vulnerability wasn't allowed. Eventually, he broke up with me because it was too hard for a 28-year-old to date a 9-year-old. I've been 9 a really long time, I finally said to Dan. Probably only with men. This is why I test them. If things are going well for a couple of weeks, I raise the stakes and force the person I'm dating to prove to me he loves me and that he's willing to do anything to prove that. I create drama so that he can mollify the situation in the name of protecting me. I just really want someone to ask me where I've been all day. Of course you do, Dan said. That's called a relationship. Now that I had a better understanding of why I was so pissed off, I could finally do something about it. Not knowing where your anger is coming from is basically the same as walking through life with a broken leg. It's fine, you tell people who are constantly looking at you with concern. Nothing to see here. It wasn't until I met Dan that I realized Chet was my very first breakup. That my 9-year-old brain had no ability to decipher between death and rejection. That my 9-year-old brain didn't understand that my brother didn't choose to die. That Chet didn't find another family with a little sister he liked more. That was simply the way my 9-year-old brain had digested it. I was reacting to the death of my brother like a spurned lover. Subconsciously, I was waiting for my brother to come home because that's what he said he was going to do. And I waited every single day for that to happen, even when I had ostensibly accepted his death. To my 9-year-old brain, it was rejection. I didn't know then that my brother's death was defining me. I didn't know that I had the ability to say no to being defined by death. Now I was with a person who could help me process what happened and turn the parts of me that acted like a 9-year-old into a self-actualized adult who had come to a better understanding of what it means to dig deep and admit your pain, thereby beginning the process of relinquishing it. I was in a place where my brother dying no longer had to define my existence. It's part of who I am, perhaps the biggest part, and it may have helped steer me in a certain direction, but it is not all of me. I define me. No event or person does this. I define me. I decide who I am and how I'm going to behave, and I choose to be better. To look more carefully, to trudge deeper, to think about other people's pasts and not judge someone for doing or handling something differently than I would. To understand my limitations, my shortcomings, that is my growth edge. Chunk. Be careful of the people you make fun of because you will most likely turn into one of them. After Tammy died, Chunk had a new spring in his step, as if 5 years had been added to his life. He was suddenly the picture of vitality. Chunk couldn't stand Tammy, and I didn't blame him. Tammy was a cunt to Chunk, and Chunk was too much of an existentialist to be bothered by Tammy's sophomoric chicanery. He stayed out of her way because he didn't want to rock the boat. I like to believe that when Tammy came home with me, Chunk thought to himself, "Here we go, another one of these dime store whore rescues. This floozy won't last a fortnight." I also expected to hear that in a British accent. I don't know why I believe Chunk was British, but there's really no other explanation for his regality. Chunk was a prince. If Tammy was my family mascot, Chunk was my husband. Everybody loved Chunk. His smooth, soft hair, his well-mannered disposition. He didn't have the body type I'm normally drawn to, but any parent will tell you none of that matters when it's your own flesh and blood. He gave our family some much-needed dignity. He was described by many as aloof, but that was also part of his charm. He had the disposition of a butler. He was congenial, but kept his distance. Without a kerchief around his neck, he was just another well-groomed dog from Bel Air. With the kerchief, he was cooler than Fonzie. He amassed a large social media presence during his time with us and never once used it for ill. He didn't troll people online or spread fake news. He was pure goodness. He loved me categorically, but that's not the only reason I loved him. It was most of the reason, but he also had qualities I didn't jibe with. When I came home drunk or stoned, he laid some heavy judgment on me. When I had friends over, he'd give me a look that said, "Lights out in 5, bitch." I tolerated it because he never said it out loud. He never diminished the meaning of his judgment with lectures. The stares stayed fresh. It made me feel I had a sort of spiritual guide, albeit a sober one. That was all until I got him his own marijuana pills. That's when the judger became the user. Soon after I got Chunk, Molly and I took him on what we presumed was his first trip to the beach. But once we got there, it was clear he had been to a beach before, possibly even as a lifeguard. He sat in front of the water, listening to the waves crash with his eyes closed while he let the wind blow through his hair, like Ernest Hemingway. Ernest Hemingway would probably have been blacked out, but for some reason that's who I always thought of when I watched Chunk on the beach. Molly said he reminded her more of Stevie Wonder at the beach, but Molly can be a contrarian. Whenever Chunk was in this state of tranquility, I wished he could drink and smoke cigarettes too, but after many failed attempts, I had to accept that neither vices held any interest for him. "Can you believe he loves the beach as much as I do?" I asked Molly. "Yeah, because he lives in a fucking icebox. He probably never felt the sun on his back. I like my house cold, and if I've been drinking, I like it even colder. I've always held the false assumption that things with fur could easily withstand freezing temperatures." "I'm just kidding," Molly said. "His fur keeps him warm," she said to assuage my fear that I was torturing my own dog. Poor thing, thought he was going to become the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and instead he lives in the Arctic. He's like a modern-day Shackleton. While on a self-imposed sabbatical between my shows at E! And Netflix, I decided it was time for Chunk to see Europe. My family and I were meeting in Spain for a week, and I believe that after years of North American travel and good plane etiquette, Chunk had earned himself the right to a trip overseas. I have an affinity for Spain because the food is delicious and the Spanish take lots of siestas. That is when I get my best work done, when whole towns are asleep. Someone from Chunk's multi-pronged medical team had given him a prescription for sleeping pills. I was advised to give him as little water as possible on the day of our journey, which seemed like sound advice for a 14-hour voyage, a 10-hour flight to Germany, a 2-hour layover, and then a 2-hour flight to Formentera. The German layover added a nice ancestral touch, since Chunk was half German Shepherd and half Chow. It would be like his very own episode of Who Do You Think You Are? When we reached the Spanish island, Chunk would also be reminded of my cleaning ladies and feel right at home. The first leg to Germany was pretty uneventful. Chunk sat at my feet during takeoff, and I used him as a footstool. Once we were airborne and I was able to recline my seat into a bed, he hopped up and I positioned him as a headrest. This configuration worked well in that he wouldn't be able to get up without waking me, and his breath would also help keep me knocked out. From this vantage point, I realized the two connected seats in the middle aisle of the first-class cabin would be an even better configuration, so I texted Brandon to purchase those two seats for our return flight so that Chunk and I could return to our homeland like a real husband and wife. Chunk's breath got trickier as he got older. I had received multiple complaints from some of my closest friends who pointed out that it was hot and strong, but to me, it smelled like home. It also smelled like little neck clams, but I'm a fan of little neck clams. Chunk is also a fan of little neck clams, which explained his breath, but I digress. The important part of this story is that I was able to tolerate Chunk's breath, which means I am capable of accepting people's shortcomings, but usually only if that person never speaks. Chunk had the only terrible breath I've ever loved. That's how I knew I was capable of unconditional love, his breath and his slender body. Neither was my first choice. My vet warned me that the sleeping pill could make Chunk very thirsty, which, as usual, did not add up. Why would I give him a pill that would make him thirsty during the only window of time when I wasn't allowed to give him water? I decided to abstain from giving Chunk or myself a sleeping pill on the flight out. That's what good parents do. They make sacrifices for their children. Chunk was a complete champ the entire way to Spain. We got up a couple times to do a lap or two, and when I had to use the restroom, I just tied his leash to my cup holder. People kept coming over and commenting on how well-behaved Chunk was, and on his looks, of course. People were always searching for the right word to describe him: regal, debonair, rakish. Chunk was always polite with strangers, but never effusive. He would entertain a stranger with a smile and perhaps a paw shake, but he wouldn't be caught dead licking someone. He had too much dignity for that. Once we got to Formentera, my sister Simone took him for his first long walk. When she came back, she described it as a disembowelment. Another reason I loved Chunk, saving his excrement for someone in my family. My brothers and sisters know I am not equipped to deal with any of the responsibilities that come with parenting, so they immediately take charge of my dependence. Likewise, Chunk knows it's better to go for a walk with anyone other than me. Halfway through the trip, I predictably became irritated with my family. I came home from a sailing excursion and took a closer look at Chunk's meds. It's not often I come across a sleeping agent I'm unfamiliar with, but it does happen. I Googled alprazolam and discovered that Chunk's medication was just a generic form of Xanax. I could have high-fived myself if I had gotten more air. It's doggy Xanax, I exclaimed to my Aunt Gabby, who was in the kitchen making everyone lunch. This is a game changer. My brother is married to a Russian woman with whom he bickers about almost anything. It could be a bicycle helmet. It is of my opinion that their three sons, my three nephews, are prisoners in their own home. But that may be because I grew up in my home and I can't relate to any kind of hands-on parenting. My sister-in-law is more than just hands-on. I believe she would actually live inside one of my nephew's ears if she could. She is supremely overprotective and consumed with everything from their grades to the temperature of all foods and liquids that enter their bloodstream. Everything has to be room temperature. Much to my dismay, I've seen this woman heat up orange juice. She is an enemy of ice and therefore, in my opinion, an enemy of the state. The first half of the week was spent finding opportunities for me and my two older nephews, ages 13 and 16, to sneak out of the house to swim in caves or jump off of cliffs where their mother couldn't find us. Advance work was necessary to introduce the boys to fun. If Olga sees anything adjacent to danger, which in her mind could be an open body of water, a lap pool, or a can opener, she will insert herself and she will cancel the fun. One must always be one step ahead of her. In the beginning of the trip, I held high hopes for the adventures I would take the boys on, but by the end of the week, I was beaten down, having given up on the hope of a meaningful relationship with my nephews until they graduated from high school and became legal. Can you believe how annoying Olga and Glenn are with the kids? I asked my Aunt Gabby. It's pretty unreasonable, she agreed. I mean, seriously, how much sunblock can you put on someone before it stops working? I'm surprised she doesn't put it in their mouths, Gabby said, handing me a plate of jamon to put on the table. I've never seen anything like it. My aunt doesn't say a lot, and it's a nice quality in a person, but nice isn't the word anyone would use to describe Gabby. Every time she sees me, she shakes her head, almost as if she can't believe what I've gotten away with in life. When I moved to Los Angeles at 19 and lived on her sofa, she told me if I wanted to be in the entertainment industry, I had better drop some weight. I've retold this story for years to friends and family alike, while Gabby has consistently denied it ever happened, ridiculing my flair for the dramatic and propensity for exaggeration. I was finally vindicated when Molly found some old home videos from that time in which you can actually hear Gabby saying on camera that if I wanted to make it in Hollywood, I had better drop some weight. Molly knows my memory has a solid track record, and when she found the evidence to support what I had been claiming for 20 years, she made sure the whole family watched the footage together in order to clear my good name. In the video, you can see my face turn bright red. Even I felt bad for me. Gabby must have felt like Hitler in that moment, but ever since then, we've had a better understanding of each other. Gabby is Molly's mother and my mother's sister, and in exchange for the living accommodations I was provided at 19, I was required to drive Molly and her eight brothers and sisters to school each morning at 7 o'clock. This is when I discovered that I never wanted children. I wasn't upset by the realization that I wasn't cut out for motherhood. I was only upset that I hadn't thought of it sooner. By the end of our family vacation week in Spain, I stopped going to meals with my brother and his family. If I woke up and heard anyone speaking Russian, I'd go downstairs for my medication. I can't take any more kids or any more Russians, I told Gabby, popping a doggy Xanax. I'm going to take a nap. But you just woke up, she told me. Who's that person? I asked Molly, gesturing to the front balcony where a woman and my sister-in-law were sitting. Oh, that's Olga's Russian friend who stopped by last night when you came down from your bedroom in your bra and underwear to get another Xanax. So I've already met her? Well, she met you, but I wouldn't say that you met her. That's how I felt about my trip to Formentera. It met me, but I didn't meet it. On our return flight, Chunk and I had the two seats next to each other with the option of putting the partition up or down. We chose down. Once Chunk and I were both comfortably settled in and each watching our respective movies, I popped a Xanax and then realized there was none left for Chunk. I didn't want to knock myself out with Chunk awake, so I took one of my weaker sleeping pills I had brought and tried to get him to swallow it. After failing to get it down his throat for the third time, I opened the capsule and emptied it into about 2 ounces of water and Chunk drank it down. I had been using Sonata ever since I learned how terrible Xanax was for your brain, the memory loss, the irritability the next day, the fact that it makes you dumb. I justified abusing it that week because of the Russian interference in my summer vacation. Right before I passed out, I wrapped Chunk's leash around my waist and tucked it into the back of my jeans. Hours later, a flight attendant shook me awake and told me that my dog was loose and running around the first-class cabin. The simple task of standing up suddenly became incredibly difficult to accomplish as I was lying on my side and had one leg swung over Trunk's seat where his body had been. My body was confusing me, as was the situation. I could hear Trunk panting, which sounded almost maniacal. I stumbled through the first-class cabin in a fugue state, scared by the heavy throat-clearing, coughing sounds I was hearing, and at one point during all the confusion, I called out Brandon's name. When I found Trunk, he was licking the bathroom door with no leash in sight. I grabbed him by the collar and ushered him back to our double pod where I had to force him to get back up on the seat. His tongue was almost touching the floor, and there was foam on either side of his mouth. He looked like he had just snorted an eight ball. I'd never seen Trunk in that state before. I grabbed one of those miniature bottles of room temperature water they give you on planes, but thought Trunk would appreciate something more refreshing, like a Fresca, and then bounced back to reality and recognized I was talking about a dog who was on the verge of swallowing his own tongue. I started by pouring the water into the tiny plastic lid, but after Trunk almost swallowed that, I made a cup out of my hand and started pouring the water in there. When that didn't suffice, I gave up and just started pouring the water directly into his mouth. He wouldn't sit still and kept yanking his head around to get out, but I held him down, trying to get a handle on the situation. The shame that enveloped my double pod took the shape of two blankets I converted into a fort, covering the tops of our seats in an effort to prevent the two of us from causing any more of a scene. "Can I get some more water bottles and a bowl?" I whispered, peeking out from under the covers. "I don't work here," the passenger across the aisle said as she sat back down in her assigned seat. The procuring of water became a tricky endeavor as I couldn't leave Trunk to his own devices and I couldn't find his leash. I looked around for the call button, which I generally try to avoid using because of how rude it seems, but I also made a mental note of possibly installing that option when I got home to Bel Air. Brandon would love a bell. When I stood up to press the button above my head, Trunk made a run for it. I dove over my seat, grabbing his tail. I hit the floor face first and felt a sharp burn around my stomach. I discovered that Trunk's leash was wrapped around my waist under my shirt. In my delirium, instead of fastening the clip of the leash to Trunk's collar, I had clipped it to one of the belt loops on my jeans. "Can we please get him an entree?" I asked the flight attendant from the floor when she headed over to me with three large bottles of water. When the flight attendant looked at me sideways, I told her I was pregnant. Once I got Trunk nicely settled with a second gallon of water and a bowl, I looked at the map in front of my seat, which told me there were 6 hours left on our flight to Los Angeles. When the flight attendant arrived with a Salisbury steak and some other gross side dishes, I took out my tray table to play the part of being the passenger who would be eating it. To cement my credibility, I asked her for a glass of red wine and some bread options. I went through the motions of taking out the silverware and cutting off a piece of the steak on the tray, and once the flight attendant was far enough away, I handed it to Trunk. By the time she returned, the entire tray was face down on Trunk's side of the seat with food splattered everywhere, while I was wrestling him to get the entire slab of uncut meat out of his mouth. She didn't even bother stopping, she just turned around and took the red wine and bread with her. There was water, food, and dog hair everywhere. I fastened Trunk's leash to his collar and placed the handle grip around my ankle. It was time to get real. I recovered the blankets and reinstalled our fort until I could get the situation under control. I rang the call button once more and ordered a double espresso. "Would you like one or two?" she asked, eyeing Trunk. A week earlier, Trunk had been too dignified to lie on his back to get his belly rubbed. He would rather be caught shoplifting than lie in such a submissive position. It was too ungentlemanly. Trunk even knew it was wrong to get a hard-on. He turned his back when he had to go number two. Trunk was August. He was esteemed. And now here we were on a flight where Trunk had lost his last shred of dignity because his delinquent mother force-fed him a human sleeping pill. I could see the headlines now. Chelsea Handler kills dog on flight from Spain. PETA would have a field day with this. Once Trunk was hydrated, his breathing slowed and he started to calm down. And then finally, exhausted from the emotional turmoil, he fell asleep. In between checking his pulse and cleaning up the food and dog hair that was splattered all over my area, I became aware of a soreness on my back and my abdomen. When I lifted my shirt, I discovered several rope burns. I quickly realized that I had to start planning for the very real possibility that Trunk might shit his pants on this flight. I had my very aromatic grapefruit hand lotion in the toiletry bag inside my purse, so the plan I devised was to scoop up any fecal matter with the MaxiPad-grade pillowcase that they give you on those planes, douse it with the hand lotion to cover the smell, and then flush it down the toilet. I had empty water bottles lined up and ready to place over Chunk's penis in case he decided to pee. I didn't know the protocol for when your dog shits on a plane. Would we be arrested upon landing? Surely this can't be a felony. Not only did Chunk not die on this flight, he didn't urinate or take a shadoobie. He waited the entire hall through customs, where the officer greeted the two of us with a, "Welcome home, Chunk," and then asked me for my passport. This kind of shit happened all the time with Chunk. Chunk was a national treasure, and I was his plus one. He'd get recognized on the streets when my houseman Oscar would take him for his morning walks, and even when he would be catching a breeze in the backseat of my car on our way to work, you'd hear other drivers at stoplights say, "Look, that's Chunk," and Chunk would wag his tail and smile. People would stop us and ask me to take pictures of them with Chunk. He probably went through life assuming getting recognized daily happens to all dogs. By the time I got home, I looked like the one who should have been on a leash through customs. I was using my eye shades as a scrunchie, I was covered in dog hair and food stains, and I was bleeding from one arm. I looked like a streetwalker. Later, when I told my vet what happened, he informed me that giving a dog a sleeping aid when they're in a state of agitation will just prolong that state of agitation. I told my vet that I was in a constant state of agitation, and whenever I took a sleeping pill, it worked. I didn't mention to the doctor that I had prescribed my own medication for Chunk, or that I had pilfered his on my family vacation. I avoided eye contact with Chunk for days after we got back from Spain. He knew I was the culprit in this situation, and I had absolutely no defense. For fear of being accused of Munchausen syndrome by proxy, I stopped giving Chunk his CBD oil, too. I knew I had overstepped, and it was time to get my dog clean. "Wouldn't you just kill to know what Chunk is thinking?" Molly asked me one day over oysters I had shucked earlier that afternoon. "Not anymore," I told her. "That's a slippery slope." My brother Glenn once told me the reason your firstborn is so special is because they're the one that makes you a parent. That's how I felt about Chunk. He made me a mother, a delinquent, useless one, but a mother nonetheless. Oh, mother. The first thing my mother did when she woke up was take a nap. She took on average 2 naps per day and was in bed for the night no later than 9 p.m. Our whole family has the sleep gene, and although I can easily get into bed for the night at 7:30, sometimes 6:30, I have an aversion to taking unmedicated naps. The last time I fell asleep during the day was after a marijuana facial, when I came home in a stupor and passed out for 4 hours at 11 o'clock in the morning. I was high for 3 days after that and haven't felt entirely right since. My mother was a la-di-da-di-da kind of person. She would go about her day humming, la-di-da-di-da-di-da. She wasn't unintelligent. She was just the kind of person who was interested in having a pleasant, ho-hum kind of day. She would never insert herself into anything adjacent to conflict. She wasn't really very good at follow-through, so she had lots of different half-completed projects at home that would usually involve some sort of jury-rigged, repurposed household item that didn't quite cut it, like a bed sheet that was converted into a window shade and embellished with a makeshift border she'd knitted that afternoon. When the project was interrupted by a nap, it was likely to be abandoned. Our house looked a lot like Sesame Street, the main distinction being it was unsafe for children. She always wanted change. She wanted newness. She got it mostly by experimenting with casseroles and rearranging furniture. You'd come home one day only to stub your toe on a bunch of cinder blocks that had been placed under your bed as your new bed frame, because my mom had decided your actual metal bed frame looked better in the backyard as an enclosure for our dog Muttley. She would have knit something for that too, crafting it to look like a questionable art installation. She wasn't crazy, and she didn't drink or take drugs. She was a homemaker, and sometimes her ideas were out of left field or in left field. Many just belong somewhere in a field. My mother could sew, knit, plant a garden, and cook. She made the thickest, creamiest macaroni and cheese and the richest, gooeyest brownies, both of which were out of a box. But she always made home and food feel better. She could cook pretty much anything, but if you ever asked her for a recipe, she'd just say, "Put a little of this and a little of that, la-di-da-di-da-di-da-la-la-la-la." There's nothing exacting about her, ever. Everything with her was always very vague. She could build pretty much anything, too. A deck, a doghouse. She even once built a stone retaining wall in our backyard in New Jersey. She could probably have built a car. It would have broken down eventually, but she definitely could have gotten something going. The women in our family are on the masculine side, to say the least. We are not girly, we are not wearing dresses, and most of us are not getting laid. My mom had two sisters, and they both had daughters, and between all 11 of us, my mom was somehow the most feminine of all of us. Her name was Rita, but I called her Chunk. When I think of my mom, the first image that comes to mind is of her standing upstairs, leaning over the balcony that looked down over our living room in Martha's Vineyard, eating whatever sandwich she had made to lull her to sleep that night, watching us play board games at the kitchen table. She liked hearing us before she went to sleep. She wanted to listen to us eating and drinking and laughing and playing balderdash, but she never played, even though my dad always did. She was never a participant. She was always in the background, but always front and center. My mom knew that her kids needed her after Chet died, and she came back to us way sooner than my dad did. Whereas my dad was incapable of grieving and finding joy at the same time, my mother instinctively managed to do both. I was 30 years old and in London for my very first book tour when my cell phone rang in the middle of the night. It was my sister, Simone. "You should come home. Mom isn't doing well." I knew this call was coming. I knew when I flew to London that my mother was going to interrupt things. 2 months earlier, I was sitting in my parents' living room when Simone came down the stairs from their bedroom, slumped down on the sofa, put her head in her hands, and sobbed. It was eerily reminiscent of when my dad lost his composure after Chet died. I had never seen Simone be weak. If I had, I didn't remember it. She wouldn't have been weak in front of me since she had always been a mother figure to me. My sister gets along with every person she meets. Everyone loves Simone. She's a conflict avoider, a passive, popular, easygoing sorority president. She's eminently reasonable. Is she really surprised by this outcome? I thought, sitting next to her on the couch. This was my mother's third bout of cancer. What did Simone think was going to happen? I didn't say those things to my sister. I felt bad for her. I also felt guilty that I wasn't dreading my mother's death as much as she was. I just wanted to get it over with. My mom had been fighting cancer for so many years, in and out of chemo and radiation, bald, not bald, always a little sick. She never complained, and when she started sleeping more hours a day than she was awake and could only eat applesauce for weeks at a time, it seemed the writing was on the wall. After all, everything had been leading up to this. The glue of the family was becoming unglued because she was tired of the chaos. She was tired of living through my father's never-ending lawsuits, his financial unevenness. Being married to my father would have given anyone cancer. My mom was tired of fighting, and she was enervated. Her idea of heaven was dreaming about life while she slept, so in her mind, I'm sure she was actually looking forward to being able to watch all of us without having to actually participate. In the afterlife, she would have a front-row seat to all of our lives, but from a higher perch and without the need to get dressed in something other than a house dress. She was worn out. I didn't feel sad that my mom was going to die. I felt sad that no one in my family seemed prepared for it. When I saw my sisters suffering at the prospect of her leaving, I felt like they hadn't learned their lesson the last time. There was my lack of empathy again, never understanding that other people may be receiving things differently. That's okay, I told myself. I didn't need my sisters to be fighters. I have enough spinach for all of us. Death. This I know how to do. Move over, everybody. I went straight to the hospital when I flew in from London, where I found my brother Glenn and my dad sitting in a hospital room like two useless cartoon characters, with my mother lying there half unconscious, weak and listless, with a fucking roommate who had visitors who reeked of cigarettes. My mom hated cigarettes. I may as well have seen a priest raping a child. The hell I raised at the nurse's station was so disruptive and hair-raising that there were people who didn't come back to work the next day, or maybe ever. I remember Glenn grabbing me by the shoulders in the hallway, telling me I had to calm down, and a nurse threatening to remove me from the hospital if I didn't, and me telling her that she would be the one getting removed. The next thing I remember was wheeling my mother's hospital bed into the hallway while I instructed my father and Glenn to grab onto any machines that were attached to her body and to follow my lead. For the record, I would like to state that never in the history of humankind has a woman been told to calm down and then calm down. We don't like that. Once we got my mom situated in a private room down the hall, I got into bed next to her. She put her hand in mine and said in the thirstiest of sounds, "Please help me die." This was the opportunity to show my mother that she could depend on me, that for all the times I fucked up and for all the grief I caused her by never listening to anything either of my parents ever said and constantly getting into trouble in and out of school, that for her last wish, I was listening and I would show up. I was going to prove that she wasn't wrong about me, that finally she could depend on me. Those were my marching orders, and I wasn't going to leave until I had fulfilled her request. It didn't occur to me that she may have said that to all my siblings, looking for anyone to bite. She spent the next week in her private room, surrounded by her children. I slept on the bed next to her every night. Sometimes, in the morning, I'd leave her side after her first dose of morphine when she would drift away again and go to the cafeteria for some eggs and then be sick at myself for having an appetite in the first place. I'd remind myself that I needed to stay strong to help my mother die. I was in full-on Joan of Arc mode, and I was not going to make dying a problem for my mother. I hadn't been so laser-focused on anything in my life ever. The one time I did leave her to go home and take a shower, I came back to find her covered in her own vomit, most of it pooled in her newly cavernous collarbones like two gravy boats. My father was sitting with all four corners of the newspaper facing her as if he were in his own living room and hadn't even noticed. He was proving to be as useless as a gorilla underwater and took up about the same amount of space. I never left her alone with the nurses or my father again. In between bouts of unconsciousness, she would spring to life and utter these fully formed sentences that would render you speechless. "Once I'm gone, you're going to find out what a piece of work your father is, and I'm going to be laughing at you from heaven," she'd say. Then she'd turn her head, close her eyes, and drift off again, and I'd be left sitting there looking at my clueless father reading the op-ed page. I remember looking at her, wondering how she could be so sharp and so with it while also floating in and out of consciousness. I learned that people have moments of clarity when they're dying called terminal lucidity, or that they'll sometimes seem like they're getting better only to fall further the next day, kind of like a death rally. "You don't know your own strength," she said to me one afternoon, squeezing my hand. "Please use it for something good. I know you're going to have a big life, but don't forget about your brothers and sisters and promise me you'll always wear your seatbelt." "Get a spoon," she said to me with her eyes closed the day I was cleaning the vomit out of her collarbones. Then she opened her eyes and said, "Promise me you'll take care of Roy and Shauna." I had no idea my mom thought I was capable of taking care of anyone, but she empowered me to think that I was, thus creating the certainty that I would be able to do so. One day she brushed my cheek with the back of her hand and said, "He needs to let me go." I looked at my father, who was sitting 5 feet away in his diurnal spot, always with the newspaper, this time with a half-eaten Egg McMuffin sitting on his knee. The fact that he hadn't inhaled it in one fell swoop meant that he must have had another meal on his way over. "You need to say goodbye to Mom," I told him. "She needs you to let her go." He peeked over the top of the newspaper to make sure he'd heard what he thought he heard. "Keep her alive no matter what. She can be on life support." I got up and I ripped the paper down the middle with my hands trembling. It was dramatic, but my mom deserved drama. She had put up with too much shit from both me and my father for way too long. If there was ever a time she would accept a fuss being made over her, it was in her death, and by one or both of the people that caused her the most grief. "Keep her alive no matter what?" I was standing in his face and his eyes widened. "Do you know how selfish that is? I've got to go show a car," he announced, bracing himself to get up from the chair he was smothering. My father never sat in a chair. He assaulted it, and the chair was seldom the same. "A car?" "Yeah, a guy called me about a car. He's in West Orange." That was when I knew my father wasn't equipped to deal with what was happening. Death had happened once, and he didn't like the way that turned out, so it wasn't going to happen again. I thought about how sad men are, how little they know about helping women with their feelings. I realize it's not entirely their fault because they're wired differently and they've been raised for thousands of years to act like this, but it's still hard when you see it up close and personal, especially when it's your own father. "Okay," I told him, "go do that. Mom and I will probably just go water skiing." There were supposed to be 4 hours between trips of morphine, but when she was uncomfortable, I would summon the nurse who would come in and reiterate to me that it had only been 2 hours since her last dose. "Do you have a fucking mother?" I wailed. I hadn't left the hospital for 5 days, and I was starting to look like Gary Busey. The nurses had stopped communicating with me soon after I arrived, and I can't blame them, but a 4-hour pain medication protocol when someone is clearly dying is a set of rules that needs to be changed. We should be allowed to help one another die. We shouldn't have to scream and yell and throw tantrums. But obviously, in the interim, I am and will always be a person willing to take on that role. There are things you can do for other people that you can never do for yourself. Whenever I have trouble standing up for myself, and yes, it has happened, I think about whether I would tolerate the situation if it were happening to one of my sisters, mother, daughter, or niece. If it's not acceptable for them, it's not acceptable for me. I was born with a torch in my hand, and I haven't always used it so judiciously, but this was an instance where I needed to protect my mother because she didn't have the strength to protect herself. She never did. She was never like that. She was shy, demure, soft-spoken, sweet, mushy, and full of womb-like feelings. She was always there for a hug or a cuddle, but I couldn't ask her for advice. She had been sidelined by my father, and the way I saw things, she had very little say in anything. If my father really hadn't loved her, it could have been a disaster. "Just answer the question!" I screamed at the nurse after she had told me it had only been 2 hours since her last morphine. "Do you have a mother?" The nurse came over and upped my mom's morphine and then put her hand on top of my mother's. I saw my mom's hand tighten around the nurse's. "Can you imagine having a daughter like this one?" she asked. When we were told it would only be a matter of days, we decided to transfer her to a hospice where they would give her as much morphine as she wanted and stop trying to force feed her. I rode in the ambulance with her head in my hands because every time we made a turn, it felt like a coconut falling from a tree. Once she was in hospice, none of us left again until she died. Well, my father did, because he, of course, needed to eat something in order to reclog his arteries every few hours. The night before my mother died, the five of us were sleeping on cots in her room. Glenn and I were sleeping on one side, while Shauna and Roy were on the other side of the room next to each other. Simone was sitting up in a chair. "Chelsea," Glenn whispered, "how long do you think Shauna and Roy have been sleeping together?" "Seriously, Glenn," Simone muttered from across the room. "That's what death is like, though. You can't only cry for 2 weeks straight. You cry, and then you get tired of crying, and someone says something, and then you're all laughing, and then it feels bad to be laughing, but it also feels so good. Without the laughter, we'd all be dying, too." The day my mother died, we were all in the room with her. Her body got cold, and Shauna, being a nurse, told us what was happening. My mom was starting to turn blue, but she was always a little blue. She had an alabaster complexion. We sat and held hands and cried together until my father interrupted us. "We're going to need to discuss the funeral details," he announced to the room with my mother's still warm body. "She's got to be buried in the plot next to Chet, so it's going to have to be a Jewish funeral." "But she's Mormon," Shauna blurted. Shauna was Mormon too. She had converted to Mormonism years earlier with the help of my mother. After Chet died, my mom threw in the towel on Judaism and got back to her Mormon roots. When Shauna was a freshman in college at the University of Delaware, my parents got a call that she was very sick and they drove to go pick her up. After weeks of testing, they diagnosed her with lupus. They say that when there is a death in the family, it's not uncommon for family members to develop diseases in the years following. Who knows if this is true, but 5 years later, Shauna got lupus and then my mom got cancer. After Shauna got sick, she turned to Mormonism. The Jews in our family were dropping like hot potatoes. "Jewish cemeteries won't allow non-Jews to be buried there," Glenn informed all of us. "We have to have a fake Jewish funeral." "Well, what about all of her friends from church?" Shauna asked. "Well, they're going to have to just pretend she's Jewish for the funeral," Glenn said, matter-of-factly, as if this is what all families did when there's a death, have a fake funeral. It seemed like Glenn had already sorted this out with my father and was breaking the news to the rest of us. "Well, what if they find out she isn't Jewish? What about her bishop or friends from church who want to say something about her?" Shauna asked. "They all know she's not Jewish." "They're not allowed," my dad told her. "They can go do their own thing." "You know, like at a local supermarket," Glenn told Shauna. Glenn can be an asshole in these instances. He doesn't mean to be, but he's just another man who doesn't know how to handle women when they are in crisis. My dad announced that he needed us to get him something to wear for the funeral. "None of my nice suits fit anymore." And then he walked out of the room. Glenn's eyes rolled into the back of his head. "I wonder why." "Dad doesn't know that Mom baptized Chet," Shauna said quietly. "Are you serious?" Simone asked, appalled. "Yes," Shauna declared. "Mom baptized Chet?" I asked. "Just another fucking thing that no one in my family ever bothered to tell me." So now we have two non-Jews that will be buried in a Jewish cemetery, Glenn declared, smiling from ear to ear. Sounds like there's an odd man out. Well, can we just baptize Dad after he dies and then they can all be buried together? Roy asked. That's a great idea, Roy, Glenn told him. That ought to fix everything. Does being baptized negate your Judaism? I asked the room. Not if you're dead when they baptize you, Glenn whispered, as he gently kissed my mother on her forehead. It was a perfect Glenn moment, tender but dripping with sarcasm. Actually, in the Book of Mormon, Shauna started, and I had to interrupt her. Please don't with the Mormon shit right now. I just can't. She'd want to be next to Chet, Simone said. Yeah, but would she want to be next to Dad? Glenn asked. We all sat in silence for a few minutes, trying to make sense of what was about to take place. Then Roy, who had had a bar mitzvah 30 years earlier and never converted, asked, Am I Mormon too? These are the times when you think no family is as fucked up as your own, and that no one on earth has been through anything close to what you've been through. We all dealt with Chet in our own way, and now it was time for us to split up and deal with my mom dying individually. But we didn't. We stuck together this time, perhaps from knowing the mistake we made last time. Shauna and I drove to the Short Hills Mall to pick out something for her to wear. Shauna has extremely short legs and two bricks for feet. Buying clothes for her is and always will be confounding. The looks of the saleswomen at Saks and Nordstrom are always entertaining to behold, if you like diplomacy mixed with a dash of bewilderment. While we were shopping, I tried to convince her that an A-line skirt was just what she needed to meet someone romantically at our mother's funeral. She reminded me that she was already married with a baby. I got her to laugh, and she got me to laugh, because that is what sisters do for each other in the depths of their despair. They cry, laugh, sing, fight, and then go see a movie, in that order. My sister and I buoyed each other that day. I thought my mom would be proud of how we guided each other through this death storm. Then we got back to Shauna's house, and when I came upstairs from putting our bags away, I found her standing in the rain on her back porch, crying inconsolably. Her husband was standing in the kitchen staring at her, not knowing what to do. Who would know what to do? Sisters. Only a sister knows how to comfort a sister, period, end of story. Men can give us a hug or pat us on the back, but only a girl will get another girl off her feet to face the rain. That is the definition of sisters. There exists between us an ineffable understanding. We don't have to ask why or how or when. We just go in. Sometimes I'm there. Sometimes Shauna is there. Sometimes Simone is there. One of us is always there. We've all been one another's mother at some point. It hurt to see Shauna in so much pain, and I felt guilty that my pain didn't cut as deep. She was close to my mother in a way that I never was. She was more dependent and more loving, and they were more alike. My sister would have taken advice from my mother. Both were reserved, sweet, and Mormon together. I never appreciated or respected that. When my sister converted to Mormonism after Chet died, it felt like one more strike against her. Religion was of no interest to me, and when I read the Book of Mormon at my mother's behest, I came away even more embarrassed for both of them. It all bored me to no end. Religion wasn't ever going to be my jam, and I didn't appreciate trying to be converted in the privacy of my own home. It all felt so sanctimonious, the notion that accepting Jesus Christ as your savior absolved you of all wrongdoing of any scale felt like a crock of shit. Shauna and my mom had a special bond, and in that moment I felt my sister's pain way worse than any pain I had myself. I knew I'd be fine. I wondered how long it would take her to be fine. She's got children, I thought. She'll get better faster because of them. I reminded myself that a parent dying is more commonplace than a child dying, therefore Shauna would have to pull herself together at some point. People's parents die all the time. This wouldn't be like last time. I remember every finger on my mother's hand and her inveterately chipped nail polish. She would never have gotten a proper manicure or pedicure. My mom had a low tolerance for that kind of frilly stuff. She liked to grow her nails long and paint them herself, but it was always a crapshoot. Her fingers were chubby, but somehow elegant. She was chubby and elegant, too. I could pick her hands out of a lineup of 1,000. She was gracious and dignified, two things I am in short supply of. My grace is grit and my dignity is outrage. She would cover her mouth when she laughed, and she hated being photographed. She was from that era. I always wanted my mom to smile bigger. I wanted that for her. She probably didn't care about it, but I wanted her to be freer. I wanted her to throw caution to the wind, not to be so ladylike, to be a little bit bawdy and crass. I wanted her to be more like me. She was nothing like me. My mother would have probably hated me had I not been her daughter. She was warm and fuzzy and chunky with lots of side pockets of meat to grab onto, which always made me feel like I was home. It's why I love meaty pets and meaty babies and meaty people. My mom wanted the best for her kids, but she and I both knew that she was probably not the person who would be providing it. She never wanted you to be sad or to cry. She had a ton of compassion and empathy in spades. She always wanted everyone to be happy, to feel better. She was soft with her touch and always had her arms open for anyone who needed comfort. She worried about Sean and Roy. She always told me she never worried about me. She never held any of my past behavior against me. She never passed judgment. She was always ready with new unconditional love. She was my mother, the person who loved me more perfectly than anyone else ever would and never asked for much in return. When my dad and I went through our rough year, she did whatever she could to make the situation better for me. She knew my father was an asshole. She knew I was one too, and with two assholes in such close proximity, I'm sure she wondered what it was about her personality that drew those types of people to her. It takes an asshole to make an asshole. You got it from your father, she told me after I told her I was pregnant at 16 and planning to move to Niagara Falls, where I could raise my baby in peace. When my mom yelled at you, it was hard to take her seriously. It was almost like she had peanut butter in her mouth. Hearing my mother curse always put a smile on my face, even when things were bad. She didn't do it often, but when she did it, you looked up. You're not having a baby. You'll ruin your life. I'll let you do almost anything else, but I will not let you bring a child into this world, not while you're still acting like one. You have no idea what that responsibility is like. Well, it doesn't seem that hard, I told her. You can just sleep all the time and never show up to anything. I was terrible as a teenager. I always had a knee-jerk reaction to things I didn't like hearing. I put my mother through hell, but she never gave up on me and she never stopped loving me. She always told me she knew I would turn out okay and that I just needed my independence. And that once I was an adult, I would shake myself out. Maybe that was another thing she made true, simply by saying it. When my father and I used to go to war, he would yell at me and throw his hands up and say, "She's not right! Something's wrong with her!" My mom would tell him not to talk about me like that, that I was in pain and that I needed to get it out of my system. I overheard her say that to him once while they were arguing about me. I thought then about how out of focus that seemed. It has nothing to do with pain. I just want a different family. I know now that it had everything to do with pain, and that what I wanted was my family back in one piece. If I took control of making my family dysfunctional, then I would never have to mourn anyone again. My best friend from high school told me many years later that my mom was the first person to tell her she loved her. I couldn't believe that. I could believe my mom did something like that, but I also couldn't believe her own parents had never told her that they loved her. Another broad reminder that your experience isn't like everyone else's. I never felt unloved. I felt disappointed and abandoned. But I never felt like I wasn't loved. No one had ever told me that before, my friend said. Your mom told me she loved me and that I was lovable. She just somehow knew I needed to hear that. The day of the funeral, I headed upstairs to my mom's medicine cabinet. Roy was already standing there looking through the options. What do we got? I asked him. Valium, Norco, well, that's like Vicodin, I told him. Codeine, that's good. Percocet, that's pretty strong. Give me the Percocet and you take the rest. By the way, all of these things make you constipated, I told him. Roy pursed his lips to indicate he had bigger problems at that moment, but I knew as a pharmacological intuit, I had the duty to inform him of all pertinent side effects. I had been prescribing drugs to people for years, and I knew the ethical guidelines that go with said profession. I can tell by someone's weight, body type, personality, and mood what the right dosage for them will be. I knew my brother my whole life. He needed a Vicodin. My dad walked out of the closet he shared with my mom wearing a pair of suspenders strapped to a pair of khakis and a shirt that he couldn't button all the way. He looked like a giant baby. I don't think so, buddy, I told him. Nothing fits, he declared. Neither does what you're wearing. What are you two doing in there? He asked, cocking his head to one side playfully. Careful with that stuff, it's strong. Roy elbowed me like we were 12. Once I was an adult, I knew I always had the upper hand with my father simply by virtue of telling the truth. It's Percocet, I told him. Do you want one? No, I don't touch the stuff, but you should take two. I don't want you to have another one of your hysterical hospital episodes at the funeral. I wondered if my father was relieved that my mother was dead. I remember looking at him in those suspenders with his giant belly protruding, thinking, why on earth did I bother fighting so hard to keep you alive when my mother was the one worth fighting for? Then I thought about my mother watching us from where she believed she was going and thought, she's already laughing at us. And then I was laughing, and then my father, and then Roy. My father's plan for my mother's funeral was exactly the kind of hijinks we'd all learned to expect from him. The funeral was a long afternoon of avoiding eye contact with anyone Mormon. This was the epitome of our family. We couldn't even get death right. After my mom died, my dad acted like my sisters and I were just going to pick up where she left off, as if there had been some indication that we had any of her talent or gift for homemaking. He simply presumed that because we were related to my mother, we could all make a casserole out of matzah. My sisters would complain about him showing up at their houses demanding a fresh cooked meal. Nothing is more annoying than someone who can't cook, pretending that they can, and none of us can cook. But somehow during that time, my father must have convinced Simone that she had the gift. She got on this recipe kick for a while because my father was tricking her into making food for him, and she'd talk about cooking as if she had just somehow magically inherited my mother's culinary skills. She acted like she was the first person who ever roasted a chicken with peaches, hopefully the last. I grew up with people always telling me that I looked like my mother. When I was a teenager, my mother was old and chubby in my eyes. I loved her, but I didn't want to look like her. Now that she's gone, I always look for myself in pictures of her. I want to resemble her now. Probably the same way parents look for themselves in their children. I guess it's all about whoever's on the other side of the looking glass. Now I want to look like my mother. And guess what? Now that I'm older, I do. My mom died a day before I was supposed to start production on my very first TV show, The Chelsea Handler Show. This was a short-lived venture that turned into Chelsea Lately. While her life was ending, mine felt like it was finally starting to make sense. I'd been doing stand-up for years, I'd published my first book, and my future had begun. New Jersey represented the past, my life was in Los Angeles. I wanted the past to be over and the rest of my life to begin. Keep moving, keep doing, keep going. Weirdly, the relationship between my mother and me strengthened after she died. It was then that I felt her looking over me and after me, way more than I felt when she was on Earth. Every day before I went on stage for Chelsea Lately, I would stand backstage and look up and imagine this warm, glowing light. Whenever I got nervous, I would always think of my mother. I'd look up and welcome her light and ask her to watch over me and to help me shine. It used to happen when I was performing, but now it happens mostly when I'm skiing, because that is where I'm willing to take almost any risk to get better. When I ski, I sometimes feel my mother's hand on my shoulder. Sometimes it's Chet's hand I feel. Slow down, I'll hear, when I'm gunning down a mountain out of control. Cool it, one of them will say, and sometimes I do. I listen to my mother more now than I ever did when she was standing in front of me. She knew I was reliable before I did. She knew about my strength before I did. She knew my sister needed extra love. And she knew my father was one big hot mess that she needed to try to shield us from, protecting us in the best way she could. She knew a lot more than I ever gave her credit for knowing. Her strength was quiet. Her determination wasn't loud or ugly. It was refined. I never knew determination could be quiet. I suppose it depends on who's got it. My mother died 22 years after Chet, the same amount of time he was alive. She had him in her life for 22 years, and then she tried for 22 years to live without him. And then she gave up. I know now that she did her best. Ayahuasca. Whereas siblings tend to police you, cousins are your partners in crime. A cousin is who you go out to breakfast with after a night of debauchery and who doesn't flinch when you ask the server to put a margarita in your omelet. My sisters would tolerate that behavior, but they wouldn't help me achieve my goal or try to reason with the server on my behalf. My cousin Molly would. I would also say that if there's anything better than a cousin or a sister, it's Molly. Technically, she is my cousin, but I think of her as my mother, father, sister, brother, and daughter. We are intertwined. My ugliest is fine with her. I wish I could say the same about her, but her breath in the morning is strong. She knows that, although it's not a deal breaker, she should always have her back toward me when we wake up. Molly is a producer on all of my projects. Karen is also a producer. Karen started out as my assistant on tour about 10 years ago and then became my personal assistant full-time. When she was ready to move on to a different role, she found Brandon and Tanner to take her place. That's why I call Karen bitch, because it took two men to replace her. Also, because she doesn't put up with anyone's shit. Karen is kind and strong, but she makes you earn her trust. She's from Oklahoma and she's a Christian. And the fact that she supports whatever I do is a testament to the strength of her character. I chose her to come on tour with me initially because she didn't speak very much. And at that time in my life, that's what I was looking for. She also knows how to run a book signing and a comedy tour. And she always lets me find out about people on my own, even though she usually has them pegged months before I do. Like the time I got sick of my therapist, not Dan, and sent Karen in my stead. After her second visit, I asked her if she felt like she was making progress. For who? She asked. For you, I said. I didn't know I was supposed to talk about myself, she said. I thought I was in there to talk about your problems. I've learned more from Karen's restraint than she could ever learn from my noise. She disagrees with me on so many topics, yet is the first one to get up and start planning when I say I want to cross the country and talk to Republicans about abortions and guns. We've grown a lot together over the years. Molly, Karen, and I are a triad. Molly's the one in charge. Karen supports the decisions Molly or I make, and I do whatever Karen tells me to do. We have an understanding. They will enable, support, and encourage me as long as I behave in a loving way toward others and myself. If I behave badly, they are more like disappointed parents whose daughter got suspended from fourth grade for the third time this year. The three of us were sitting around my office brainstorming about a documentary series I was filming for Netflix. We had chosen three topics, marriage, race, and Silicon Valley, and my allergic reaction to technology, but we needed a fourth. I think I should do one about drugs, I said. It's kind of like my wheelhouse, no? Yes, they both said in unison, as if I asked this question several times a day. Do you think Netflix will let you do that? Molly asked. Won't that just sound like another one of your boondoggles? Molly likes to write down words that I throw around or misuse, look them up, and then use them properly in a sentence directed at me. You guys want to do it with me? I asked them, winking at Molly for her on-point usage of boondoggle. I'm not doing any drugs on camera, Karen said, zipping up her sweatshirt. I would, Molly said, but if we film this, I'll technically be working. I don't think anyone's going to go for that. Why not? Karen asked. Chelsea will also be working, which she put air quotes around. Yes, but Chelsea's work requires different things from her than ours does from us, Molly reminded her. My first choice of drug was mushrooms, my favorite, but that's pretty much illegal everywhere. Someone mentioned ayahuasca. This is the drug that's derived from a plant in South America and brewed into a tea that you drink. More often than not, you shit your pants, vomit, and then have some sort of transcendental experience, in that order. There are some people who actually have mental breakdowns during their experience, but I've always felt that I'm not a candidate for that sort of thing. I don't know how I feel about shitting my pants on camera, I told Molly and Karen. Why? Molly asked. That seems like something you would do. They don't have to film you actually shitting your pants on camera, Karen reminded us. And I'm sure you don't have to shit your pants. I'm sure production can secure a toilet or a bucket for you. They can't force you to shit your pants like a baby. But can we? Molly asked Karen, with one eyebrow raised to somewhere between the middle of her forehead and her hairline. To do it legally, you'd have to go to South America. It says here Peru is pretty much the place for that, Karen said, squinting at her computer. Molly's eyes lit up and she wiggled her shoulders. You love Peru. Molly and I had just come back from Peru, where we'd gone after I announced that I was ready to tackle my phobia of snakes. The idea was based simply on the time of day, the amount of marijuana in my system, and my willingness to travel anywhere for any reason. We were in Santiago, Chile, tagging along on one of my brother Glenn's business trips, or boondoggles, when it dawned on me that Peru was basically up the street. We had gotten some weed off of our 67-year-old driver in Santiago, who refused to take any money for it, being that selling drugs in Chile is a crime, whereas gifting them is not. We were all very stoned and exhausted from walking around the city for hours. For some reason, Glenn had dragged us from one corner of the city to the next as if he owned the place, until finally Molly and I told him to fucking cool it. Don't go to Peru, Chelsea, Glenn scowled as we sat in the bar of the Ritz-Carlton in Santiago, catching our breath. That's going to be a full-blown nightmare for you. There are snakes everywhere. Ooh, this is going to be scary, Molly said as she started looking up flights. I have no fear of dying, I proclaimed. No one should fear dying, Chelsea. It's going to be glorious, Glenn said, smiling longingly. Flying, Glenn. I meant flying, not dying. Commercially? She means coach, Molly interjected. Some of these smaller planes don't have first class, so the whole plane is coach. I'd fly coach if it meant finally conquering my fear of snakes. Can you imagine if you had to be a flight attendant, Chelsea? Glenn asked me, smiling and looking off into the distance. In coach, Molly added. You'd be collecting unemployment. This image delighted him to no end. Or in jail, Molly said. I got up and tried to find some chicken fingers. When I realized they weren't just sitting on a table in the lobby of the Ritz-Carlton, I came back to the bar and asked them what